that the human eye can discern a density difference of 0.01. Therefore, if that's true, the number of discernible shading levels that the artist would have to be able to work with, if he's going to do this with some kind of eye-hand coordination technique, would be the amount of density of the difference of the image divided by the ability for the eye to resolve that density. That's 0.07 over 0.01 is 7. So he has 7 levels of shading that he can work with. That means, and if we say, if we take the 3.4 centimeters is encoded into this amount of reflective density, that means that the human eye would be able to discern, putting the image onto the shroud as it appears on the cloth, an effective distance of 3.4 over 7 levels, or about a half a centimeter. It would be like trying to create a sculpture of a three-dimensional face in the levels of the shading using a half a centimeter chisel, not a very fine one. And of course, you have problems with lips because they're, for example, they would have distances less than that. To put this another way, I have another slide. I took a human face, actually it's mine, and it's in the dotted lines right here, and I offset them by the half a centimeter. What that means is that any line that you can draw between those two boundaries is equally probable as any other line that you can draw from there, and that's those set of profiles that could be generated this way are the kinds of things that you could expect from a if an artist were going to try to do this. Next slide just shows the solid line. Okay, there's forehead, here's his sort of nose, and there's the lips. Now this is just an arbitrary drawing on my part, but just to illustrate the point that this would be presumably a possible outcome that an artist would have in trying to encode this distance information. Okay, next slide. By the way, could we back up that slide once more, please? I would also like to point out that there is still a correlation, I mean, that we could expect. There's evidence of a kind of a nose and some lips and so forth. I mean, there still is correlation. But the question is the correlation equivalent to that which we see on the shroud, which I have just shown you on the VP8 images? Next slide. Well, I think what I thought was a relevant thing to do in light of this was to try to do a more controlled experiment rather than just simply look at images. In other words, we might be able to suggest that an artist may not think of encoding the distance information, but what if he did? What if he thought of it? Could he do it, is the point. So what I did is I took the same statue face that I showed you before, and I asked two artists to try to construct this face for me and shade it. In other words, try to encode the spatial geometry of that face into the relative shadings of their drawing. The artist that I used, is that 10 minutes?
Yep.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Time sure goes by fast. The artists that we used were police artists, certified police artists, because I wanted somebody who doesn't put creativity into it, but actually does this with as much realism as possible. Now, I also gave them the constraint of working within that density variation of 0.07. Actually, it was 0.01, a little bit higher than I gave them. And we used the density step wedge to establish that they would work within those limits. Now, I'd like to show you the results of that. And by the way, the density variation was done on a piece of paper that had the neutral density of pure linen as measured by Samuel Pellicori, who you'll hear from later on in the symposium. Next slide. If you can see it, this was the first artist attempt right here. The peak of that nose is no greater than 0.1 density units. Okay, so we're trying to make this like the image on the shroud in terms of density. Okay, next slide. This is a contrast-enhanced picture of what he did. And it's also done in negative. This is his face. Next slide. This is the VP8 of it. Next slide shows it from a rotated point of view. Next slide. This is the profile. Here's the head. His nose is kind of flattened here. There's the sort of lips and mustache and then the beard of the statue. Next slide. Here's the second artist. There's his image, nose. I have to apologize. I wasn't able to get a VP8 of this prior to the conference. I have his picture of it, which I'd be happy to show anybody who would like to see this. I would have to ask you to take my word that it is deformed very severely also. Next slide. Okay, this is the positive negative that he, the negative picture, next slide, of his. The next one was an image that I did. I wanted to control. I thought it would be worth having a hack in there to try it too. But at least I have done a lot of thinking about this three-dimensionality aspect of the image, and so I thought maybe I'd like to try it too. I'm not an artist by any means, but that was my attempt. I overshot the density limits by about a factor of 5. But anyway, I'll show you the result. Go ahead. Next slide. Here's my very wonderful negative picture. Next slide shows my VP8 of it. Next slide. Okay, then I said, well, okay, maybe I made it too hard on them. Maybe what I should have done is to give them the distance information in the first place. In other words, if I give them the contours of an actual human body. Well, better, I thought, I'll do better than that. I'll give them the actual shading distribution of a photograph taken with our with a phosphorescent head. Next slide. That's this one. I gave them this photograph. This has distance information encoded into it. Let me prove that with the next slide. Okay, there's what the VP8 does with that one. Okay, I then did not impose any constraints on shading. They could go to however dark they wanted to make it. I simply asked them to copy that photograph. Next slide. This is the positive negative, or the negative of that image with its shading. The next one is the VP8. Next slide is the other artist who copied the photograph. Next slide is the VP8. Okay, next slide. Gives us again the image itself, the picture that they were looking at for comparison. Next slide. I think we're going to have to go transfer to the next tray, please. So with all this, I have a hard time seeing how this image could be the work of an artist by simple eye-hand coordination. Was that 5 minutes, John?
Yep.
Thank you. Nope. Just go. You have to advance it to the somewhere in here. Is that the start of it? Okay. Well, then, if I've looked at the artist hypothesis, let me look at a couple others. One hypothesis would be that the image is the result of a direct contact mechanism. That is, where the cloth touches the body, you have an image. Where it does not touch the body, you don't have an image. There have been several examples of that, which I can look at with the VP8 also. There's the shroud image for comparison. Next slide. This is a bas-relief of Bing Crosby that someone did. The cloth was placed over the face, and then the image was transferred to it. Let me show you the positive-negative characteristic. There's the way the image looks. Here's the negative of it. By the way, this was done by a man named Joe Nicola. I wanted to mention the name to give credit. And this is pretty good, I think. But let's look at the VP8. And so I'm disoriented. I think this is the face here. Well, anyway, next slide. Here was a direct contact mechanism, the positive and negative. VP8 is next one. Looks like that. Next slide. Here's another one that was done. I believe this was Rodante who did it. Next slide. Well, we'll show the one on the right. There it is. In short, direct contact mechanisms do not seem to explain the nature of this image. Next slide. There's another direct contact mechanism. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, if we look at a few radiation-produced images, I took photographic film over the phosphorus and face, draped it over it. What you get, if you just drape the image over it, you get an image which is totally blurred, totally without any image shading, and it looks like this. If we put an attenuating liquid in there, we can get some resolution, but we have looks like distortion in the image. Next slide, I think, shows the VP8 of the one up on the right. Looks like this. Okay, I think I heard John tap. Did I hear you tap?
Yep.
That was the final tap.
Right.
You're telling me to get off. Okay. could we go to the last, I think it's the last slide. No, it's the, it's not the last slide, but it's about five from the last. It's a conclusion slide. I'd just like to just show that to you, and I'll stop. Go forward. Forward some more. Just move. Yeah. Are we shot? Well, I'll try to summarize the conclusions. Why don't we just turn the house lights on, and I won't bother to show you that slide. Okay, it's my opinion that the image on the shroud, first of all, does contain distance information, distance with respect to the body surface relative to expected clock body distances. This doesn't prove it, but I can't say that as a proof, but it's the only way that I can see to really explain what we see on the shroud. I don't see that the image could be the result of an eye-hand coordination. I don't believe an artist could do it. I also don't believe that the image on the shroud could be the result of a direct contact process. Radiation has its problems as well. So I can't tell you what caused the image, unfortunately, but that's what we have tried to do, and I thank you for your attention.
For people who aren't familiar with some of the terminology, I'll explain a little bit. Image digitization, the first step in this process, requires taking an image. In our case, we are photographic negatives to work with, putting it through a machine. There's an example of one. It's basically an automated microdensitometer, and it works like this. You focus a very tiny spot of light, maybe 25 microns, onto a piece of film at a spot. You record the amount of light that is transmitted through the film at that point. That's measured and recorded numerically onto magnetic tape. The machine moves over maybe 20, 25 microns, whatever you want, and makes the same transmission measurement at the next point. And this is repeated over and over again until you have scanned across the entire negative. For things like the shroud images, we will run as many as 4 million points out of an image. The general images you work with are on the order of 2,000 picture elements squared. This takes a while. The machine does most of the work, but it is a slow process. But anyway, when you get done, you end up with a set of numbers that represent the intensities in the image at this matrix of points within the picture you have. This data that we have, Vern Miller, in fact, will talk about the photography, the pictures that were taken. I'm not going to talk about basically the data we have to work with. What we have done so far, we have scanned the ultraviolet medium resolution data, the blue, green, red images of what we call the quads. That's when we were able to capture the entire shroud in 4 pictures. And then some of the medium resolution data at 2 of the bluer wavelengths. This is probably a tenth of the total data we have. So the whole process of digitization and so on is not very far along, so the rest of it is not very far along. And in fact, there is more work of the digitizing going on at Los Alamos, I believe at EG&G, and eventually we will get all of the data that we want, but we are only maybe 10-15% along. Okay, that's creating the data set to work with. The meat of image processing, though, is the actual process of extracting the information you want and displaying it. And that's kind of a key thing, is displaying it in a manner that is most readily amenable to interpretation. Whether it's a simple enhancement where you increase contrast, much as you do photographically by going to higher gamma. In the machine you can increase contrast, or you can go to fancier things like picking out frequencies, picking out colors, and so on like that. But basically you extract information you want and display it in an optimum manner for interpretation. That is the object of all of this work. Some of the simplest things that were done, and I really don't have any show and tell stuff from this, but the simple things were detailed enhancements. A little bit of work has been done on that. Let me have the next slide. Just for those of you who are not familiar with it, the actual process of image processing, most of it now is done what we call interactively, where the analyst sits down and plays with the data, puts up the image he has to work with, he does some processing on it, displays it, and this iteration goes on until he arrives at what he wants. I wish I should have had a slide of one of the guys working with the shroud data, but unfortunately Vern Miller's got all those good ones, so I have to wait to have him show. But that's the process that goes on. So the creativity comes out of the analyst's brain, the mechanics is done by the computer and the display equipment. All right. Now the detailed enhancements, as I said, there has been a little playing around going on at JPL. Some more has been done at Los Alamos. There hasn't been major significant things come out of that, except for one thing. Can I have the next slide? In doing, this is the wound in the side, the blood stain from the side, okay? In doing kind of detailed contrast enhancements, stepping through the intensities, you find that this is pretty uniform intensity all the way through here, except for a kind of a elliptical, maybe sort of kidney-shaped area up here, is slightly more intense. And in fact, I think I saw the same effect in some of Bill Modern's previous slides. Now, what that means, I don't know, but there is a slightly heavier stain up in that upper area. We want to do the same kind of thing in the foot area, in all of the wound areas, and see if there's any more detailed information can be extracted but that work has not been done yet. Another one of the tasks that we had to do before we can really get into the meat of the work, can I have the next slide, please, is when we took our photographs, Bern did a superb job of setting up the equipment, of doing his homework, and we produced the most uniformly illuminated images we could. However, when you do a detailed enhancement and really increase the contrast, you see that the images, there was a much more illumination, they're brighter in the center, and it falls off to the edge. Now, this doesn't really hurt your enhancement in a single image, but it totally distorts any comparison of images, any color analysis, or any quantitative analysis similar to what John Jackson showed. So one of the things that had to be done was say, okay, can we simulate or create images that as they would have appeared with uniform illumination? So some of the work that was done, next slide, was to take a series of images, in this particular, this represents the green in the quads, take a series of images, take out details, smooth them, average them, and create a model of the illumination field. And that's what you're seeing here, is an enhanced model of the illumination field. Next slide. That model is then subtracted from the image to produce what I call a simulated uniformly illuminated image. This is sort of what the image you had would have looked like if you had a nice flat illumination. Now, given this data, you can now proceed to do things like color and quantitative analysis and comparison between images. Next slide. All right, so another aspect of the work that was done too is basically to respond to requests from other people. In particular, John Jackson, in his previous talk, talked about the 3D work, that three-dimensional analysis, if you want, or the analysis of the distance encoded into intensity. What we did was gave him digital numbers, quantitative numbers, of the intensities at various places in the image. In particular, this is a graph, an overlay of the lines on which John was given the detailed numbers. So in addition to getting numbers, he gets a printout or a picture that looks like this that tells him where those numbers come from. Next slide. The most fun in a lot of this work is color. Not real color. The photographers produce good, pretty real color. But the fun comes in using color to identify areas, to exaggerate things. And this, in an instance like this, you do the same thing with color that you do in contrast enhancement. You increase what may be subtle differences between color, you greatly exaggerate them, and make small color differences stand out. In particular, this is the upper body image from the quad images, where we have taken a red, a green, a blue monocolor image, done the illumination flattening, if you want, combine them to create color image, and then do the exaggerated color. Now you can see, in particular, the blood stains really stand out. That was the intent of this. We drove the redder parts of the image to very red, the bluer parts of the image to very blue. Unfortunately, we found that when we did this, you've got this kind of a shading from blue down to green, which said it wasn't quite right, there was something wrong. So we had to see if we couldn't correct that. And in fact, fairly recently, like last week, We went through and didn't correct it exactly. We found that in the scanning process, one of the sets of quads was shifted incorrectly. We didn't go back to zero. We made another compensation for that. Next slide, please. Went through and smoothed it out, and I will show you those exaggerated color. This is the dorsal image, the upper body. Again, and you can see the very red, the almost, reddish purple, are blood. I mean, they are that correlate with the things called blood stains on the cloth. You can see that in the scourge mark areas, there are blood stains in the top of the head and so on, all the way down. Next slide. This is the dorsal foot area. And one thing these images do, in looking these over, you will often see something which is subtle, which is in the raw images, but it is either too faint or kind of so close to something else that you really don't notice it. And we have found in these images areas that were not really readily discernible in the black and whites or in the color photographs. Yet when you go back, yeah, you can find them. So you use these kind of images to highlight things, then you can go back and do detailed analysis later. Next slide, just for your, this is the dorsal foot, or the frontal foot area, and next slide, let you look at that one for a minute. I think that one's kind of pretty. All right, the third area of effort, and I put this in here kind of because it represents not only significant effort, but I think a significant item in this whole Shroud project. What I call other is basically responding to requests for information about the Shroud and about the project. Now that doesn't sound like much until you realize that we've had over 1,000 requests for information. Now this is service to send out references and so on like that, and requests for talks. I think if there's one thing that has surprised me more than anything else out of this Shroud project, it is the incredible interest, both in the technical community and the normal, and the everyday people, okay? That normal community is probably closer to right. Sorry, fellas. The interest has been, to me, incredible. I have given talks, somewhere upwards of 75 talks over the last 3 years, from groups of people ranging from 30 to 3,000, from local church groups to, in fact, the staff at NASA headquarters. In places like Goddard Space Flight Center and Ames Research Center up in Sunnyvale. Goddard is out in Greenbelt, Maryland. I gave talks in what they call an engineering symposium or the technical colloquium, whatever the particular local institution has. In all cases, they had the largest audience that they had for the Shroud talk that they had for any talk they've ever had. And the feedback, the response, was greater than anything they ever had. In a specific example, and this is NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., they asked me to give a talk at 10 o'clock in the morning. We filled the conference room, which was on the order of 250 people or something like that. It was filled 15 minutes ahead of time. So they said, well, could you give another one at 2 o'clock? Sure. So we repeated at 2 o'clock. Again, the conference room is full. He said, could you do it again at 4 o'clock? And I said, sorry, I was just about out of gas by that time. I had to go back home. But that's indicative of the amount of interest, As I said, both in the normal community and in the technical community. That, I think, is very significant. It is surprising to me, but it's very pleasing. But it says people want to know, no matter how skeptical, no matter, in fact, it's kind of interesting at work. We run into the people who are, you know, this is all garbage as far as they're concerned, all right? But yet, they want to know what the latest information is, and that's always fun. So, that's kind of really all I've got to say from my part of it. From our aspect, the image processing, image analysis is really, we have barely scratched the surface.